So today's reading is from Genesis 37, verse 2 to 36, which is on the inside of your handouts. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bila and Zilpha, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of the other sons, because he was a son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us, or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in his mind. Now his brothers went to the pasture, their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hand, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite tribers passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my brother, to my son, mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard.
Thank you, Rachel, for reading so well for us. And please do keep that passage open. As Charlie mentioned at the start, there is an outline on the back. You'll kind of need to flip between the two if you'd like to make use of that. I closed my eyes, drew back the curtain to see for certain what I thought I knew. Far, far away, someone was weeping, but the world was sleeping. Any dream will do. You might recognise that as some of the lyrics from perhaps the most famous song from the Joseph musical, written by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. Now, as you hear that, maybe, in fact, some of you have even been Joseph in a musical. I once gave a talk on this passage, and it turned out there were two people who had actually been Joseph in the room. Or maybe musicals are just not your kind of thing. Quite frankly, it brings you out some kind of rash. It's just not the kind of genre that you're really into. But at least you've heard of the story, and you know about the musical. And your best reaction, though, is something like this. Oh, that's a nice story. How quaint. It's great that the kids know about that. But over the next 4 weeks, I hope we're going to see this story afresh, with fresh eyes, as grown-ups. That's why we call this series Joseph for Grown-Ups. And I hope we're going to see, over the course of the next 4 weeks, now this is a very challenging story, and a story that is full of surprises, of twists and turns, and that brings the book of Genesis as a whole to a very dramatic close. In fact, the start of the story is something of a surprise. Take a look at verse 2 with me, and let me show you what I mean. These are the generations of Jacob. I think that's a bit of a surprise. It doesn't mention the coat in the first verses. In fact, it's not really even about Joseph. It's rather about Jacob and his descendants. It is about God's family, the chosen people, the promised people. And it centres on this one family. And there are high hopes for this family, because this family really matters. It's God's people. And it is they that are at the centre of God's plan for the world, to rescue, to save the world. Let me read out some verses from earlier on in Genesis, from chapter 12. I put the references there on the sheet in case you'd like to look it up for yourself later. Let me read from Genesis 12. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Well, here we have the family. Against all the odds, against all the struggles, they are assembled, brought into existence. The foundations of the 12 tribes of Israel. And they matter because they have a big job to do, which impacts all of us, which is to rescue the world, to change the world, to change the bad news stories into good news stories. They are to be a people that has an impact on all the families of the earth, as it said in those verses that we just heard. And we know that our world is in trouble, that it needs saving. We only need to read our news reports to know that. And in the middle of all of that, though, there is an additional promise. And it is one of a king, of a ruler. It's there in that reference I put down there on the sheet from Genesis chapter 17. And so therefore, we are looking for a leader. Well, that might help. A leader who can lead the world into the change that it really needs somehow. And so all eyes then are on this family, this one family. Well, let's meet the family. Our first heading there on the sheets is this: the out of control family. I don't know if you noticed, as Rachel read it, the number of times that it says brothers. It happens so many times in our passage. It mentions the word brother. In fact, it's 21 times. And it turns out that these brothers, this family, are very dysfunctional. Now, maybe some of us identify that with some of that. Maybe our family isn't what we'd like it to be, and we feel some of that deeply. But this family are something else. Take a look at the beginning of our passage, how that goes. Let's take it from verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. This is pretty shocking stuff. Jacob here, with his favoritism, kicks everything off. The last time we looked at Genesis, a few weeks back, we saw this kind of unedifying spectacle, this kind of competition between the wives, for children, almost like a football competition, an episode of Match of the Day, where they were trying to get one over the other, score more goals. And verse 2 gives us a really compact summary of that fact. Brothers born to two different mothers and two surrogates, Leah and Rachel, and the two servants, Bilhah and Zilpah. But Jacob loves Joseph more than the others. He really is daddy's boy. He gets the coat, he gets the gear. And this favoritism has a very corrosive effect on everything. So we meet Joseph. Daddy's boy comes with a bad report, or we could say actually evil report. At the end of the book, in chapter 50, verse 20, the brother's actions are described using the same word. He is more than a snitch, a telltale. And then he tells his tale of these two dreams, and we'll come back to that. But then we meet the rest of the brothers, and they are described three times as full of hate and jealousy, verse 11. Jacob's love for Joseph has, well, it's led these brothers to hate. Reuben is the eldest. He's supposed to take a lead. But we see in chapter 35 that he sleeps with Bilhah, mother to two of his brothers. And from then on, everything is a failure for him. He manages to stop Joseph's death, immediate death. But he fails to stop everything else that happens in the rest of this account. Well, what about the next two brothers in line? What about them? Maybe they do better. Simeon and Levi. Well, no, they are rash and violent. And we see in chapter 34 that they slaughter the whole city in an act of revenge. All the males are killed. Judah's up next. He ends up as leader of the gang. At last, someone maybe to take a lead. Well, that's a good sign. Well, look at what he says and does. Take a look at verse 26 of our passage. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. He wants the money. He wants to cash in his own brother, his own flesh and blood. Nice little earner. And it gets worse in chapter 38. He marries outside of God's promises, ends up sleeping with his daughter-in-law, who he thinks is a prostitute. He can't make this kind of thing up. If you wanted to tell a nice story about Joseph, this is the kind of stuff you'd want to edit out, all of it. Well, what about the rest of the brothers? Well, they're full of hatred. They're in on this plot. They conspire together, and it makes all of those TV shows on Netflix, like House of Cards or Breaking Bad or whatever it is maybe that you watch, look pretty tame in comparison. They all listen to what Judah says, and they're not just yes men though. They go along with it actively. He's stripped of his clothes, this robe, this coat. and he's put in a pit. They sell him off. They cash him in. They sell him off to an enemy nation, the Ishmaelites, not those the people, or rather people of promise. And you can only imagine how he felt, but we're not told how he felt. We just got the bare facts. He just feels so cold. Later on, we're told that he begged, but they didn't listen. Next, they fake his death. They use the symbol of this favoritism, the coat. They really rub Dad's nose in it. They use it to fake his death. It's so callous. This is their father. Dad is full of grief. He says it will be the death of him. What a family. What a mess. How heartbreaking. But Joseph's dream says that he is to be the ruler, the leader. Not likely now. Not with this family. This out of control family. Bless all the families of the earth. Save the world. Not likely. You've got to be kidding. They instead seem to be ruining God's plan. The plan seems to be out of control. It's like a car that is careering down a hill with no brakes. Only it looks like now somebody has hit the accelerator pretty hard. We said at the start that maybe a leader might help. Do any of them make the grade? Any of them got leadership potential? Well, no. Tragically, no. One by one, they are ruled out. God can't seem to stop this disaster from unfolding, it seems. In fact, it's worse. God, did you notice? God isn't even mentioned in this story. It seems that he is silent, absent, not there. Hello, God, are you there? What are you doing? Is he hiding? Is he there at all? Does he exist? Is he sleeping? Is he on holiday? Where is he? I wonder if you've ever wondered that, or maybe someone you know, someone you work with, has asked that question or thought that. And there are many worldviews out there in the world that would say that, wouldn't they? It's not just atheists, though. Perhaps sometimes even we think like that. But functionally speaking, we're fatalists. God's distant. He's not really there on the scene very much. It is what it is. Que sera, sera. What will be, will be. He's not around very much. Or maybe deists. Deism is the idea that God has kind of wound up the world like a clockwork toy and he was there at the beginning, but he's not involved day to day. He just lets it go, lets it set off. It's almost like he's left the field of play, or he's not really around very much. Every so often he kind of intervenes and blows the whistle like the referee, but all too often he's not around. He's not involved in the day-to-day action, what's going on the pitch in the world. I wonder if we ever think like that. And we wonder, where is God then? Where is he in my office, in my situation, in my world, in this world that we live in, the world of our news reports? Well, secondly then, God in control and at work through this family. God is actually in the very midst of all of this, in control and at work. He is at work through his man, Joseph, and even through these evil men. How do we see that? How can you possibly say that? Well, there are hints, and the clearest one, I think, as it relates to God's man, Joseph, is that God is speaking to him and through him. Now, he's not speaking like he did with the patriarchs, like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, where he spoke directly. Instead, he is speaking through these dreams, revealing what he is going to do in the future. He is there, and he is at work behind the scenes. There are two dreams, and these two dreams represent two pictures to confirm that this really is what is going to happen. And the dreams actually occur three times in the book. We get Joseph's dreams here. Then later on, we get his prison mate's dreams. And then Pharaoh's dreams. Now, it is not because he has had too much cheese or something like that. That is not why he has these dreams. It is because God is at work. Now, let me read some verses to you from further on in the story. This is taken from Genesis chapter 40. Let me read for you. And the reference is there in case you want to follow it up yourself later. But this is Genesis 40 and verse 8. They said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." And then, chapter 41 and verse 16, we read this. This time it's not the prison mates, but it is Pharaoh himself. Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favourable answer." Do you see what he's saying? The dreams and the meaning of those dreams, that all comes from God. And so it is that these dreams mark out Joseph as God's man. God is at work through him. And it turns out, as we read on to the end of the story, he will be the ruler. They will bow before him. And he is the one who is needed to save the world. In fact, to save the family first, and then the world. But the brothers don't like it. But look at Jacob. His response to these dreams is very different. Take a look at verse 11. "And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind." He considers these words. He doesn't reject them out of hand. And it is the best thing I think he does. God is at work through Joseph. We need to see how this unfolds. But God is at work. There are signs, hints here, right, even at the beginning, in all this mess. And he is even at work through these evil men, through the brothers. There again, there are hints as the story goes on. Verse 24 is intriguing. It tells us, almost this kind of offhand comment, that there is no water in the pit. Why do we need to know that? Well, it's so that he doesn't drown. They throw him in the pit. If he'd been full of water, he would have been dead. End of story. God is there, behind the scenes at work. And they change their minds so they don't kill him. Again, God is at work. And then you think of all the other details of what happens in the story. Just think how in control you have to be to pull all of this off, even here in this story at the beginning. The timing, the precise timing of when these Ishmaelite traders, when they turn up, who they decide to sell him on to, where he ends up, the place he ends up, the house he ends up in. This verse at the end, verse 36, almost a throwaway line, seems inconsequential. In Egypt, in the house of Potiphar. And as we read on, we see God is in control. In fact, this is what God said would happen in Genesis 15 and verse 13. We are told that they will end up, God's people will end up in Egypt. Here is the start of all of that. Well, what does that tell us? Well, God is keeping his promises. He is active. He is at work in all this mess. This seemingly out of control situation, he is in control of it. And so therefore, he is not the God of fatalism, of que sera sera. He is not the God of deism that winds up the world like a clock and just lets it go and says, "Well, see, let's see what happens." He is not absent. He is not sleeping. He has not gone AWOL. He is at work. Even when we can't see it. In fact, when we can't even see him, he is there. He is behind the scenes. He has everything in hand by his hidden hand. And we need to know that. We need to know that when we come to wonder, where is he? What is he doing? What is he doing in my bit of his world? What is he doing in the world around us? Now, I know that raises lots of questions. And we need to read on. So come back next week as we start to grapple with some of these issues. But we do get the start of an answer here. Only hints. As we go on in the story, it becomes clearer. And then as we go on, we discover that God is much bigger than we imagine him to be, than we think he is. He has everything in hand by his hidden hand. He is at work, keeping his promises to us, and to the world. I said earlier that this isn't really a story about Joseph. It's about the whole family. Well, it is, of course, about Joseph as well. He's integral to the story. But here we end with him in Egypt. And I wondered, as it was read out, as we've been thinking about this together over the last few moments, I wonder whether any of this rings any bells with you as we move on to the New Testament. There is another character that I think this points to, another person this points to. Like Joseph, he had words to say, words from God, words about himself, words claiming to be a ruler, the one whom everyone should bow before, but not just one family, the whole world. God's ruler, God's anointed one, in fact, God himself. And what do they say in response to those words? Let's kill him. So they plot, they conspire. They do it for money. Money changes hand, 30 pieces of silver. The clothes get taken away. He is put in a pit in the end. He is killed, actually killed this time, for claiming to be God's ruler. He is killed by his own people. This is a picture of the gospel. This is a picture of Jesus Christ, the one who can and does save the world. God is at work, and he sets this up thousands of years beforehand so that when he came, we would understand and see. So that we see him coming. Is God there? Yes, he is. And 2,000 years ago in history, he came and lived among us. Jesus Christ has come, and one day he will come again to set everything straight. Well, let's close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this picture of this hopeless situation of this out of control family, and for showing us that through all of this, in all of this mess, you are in control, keeping your promises for the world, promises for us. Please would you help us to see this and to believe it and to trust you when we see circumstances around us that look so out of control. In Jesus' name, amen.